our roadways, and I appreciate very much your being here and making this presentation. Hopefully, committee members will be joining us here shortly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Arsenault.
And members, my name is Bernie Arsenault. I'm the Deputy Commissioner and Chief Engineer for the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come today and share some thoughts about a program that we have we are developing right now as a way of addressing some of the needs that have been brought to us both through the public and through some other stakeholders across the state. It's called the Corridor Investment Management Strategy. And what I'd like to do here first is walk through kind of the both the setup to how we got to SIMS and then what SIMS is. And I recognize that there will be an interest in some questions and answers, and I'll certainly leave plenty of time for that.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so the Corridor Investment Management Strategy is really a program, again, as I mentioned, that we're trying to address needs that have been brought to us that aren't really addressed through a performance-driven approach. And in order to set that up, I think it's important that we review the MnDOT strategic vision. Our vision is to deliver a safe, efficient, and safe, efficient transportation system and sustainable transportation system that allows us to be a global leader in that area. I mean, our goal is set high. We want to be global leaders, and that's what we set out since Commissioner Sorrell came to MnDOT. We also have a sustainability policy, and you're going to see some things woven through this presentation, and there's going to be some consistencies here, and they're going to really be around quality of life, around economics, and around the environment. And this is setting that up through our sustainability policy statement, where we are looking at those three areas and balancing them as we make decisions about the transportation system. We recognize that in the definition that we have adopted for sustainability, it's important that you look at these three areas and try and develop solutions that address all three of them. I think an old definition for sustainability focused around environment only, and we are not at that point. We recognize the value of economic development. We also realize the importance of managing our environment and making sure that we are good stewards of the environment. And ultimately, it is about the people that we touch, the quality of life that we provide related to the transportation system. And we did a lot of work on quality of life study over the last year or so in partnership with the University of Minnesota. Excuse me. We identified in our studies about quality of life, we went out to the people of Minnesota and asked them, what does quality of life mean to them? We didn't identify that we are DOT, and so we didn't want to taint the results. But we did find out that transportation is an important part of the quality of life of the people of Minnesota. And it's more noticeable to the people when our transportation system is in a poor state of health. When it's better, it is still important, but when it is bad, it becomes very important. We did a factor analysis among this study, and this is really a robust set of data across the state, and other agencies are using them. But in the factor analysis, we recognize that transportation falls in the same grouping as education, environment, employment, and housing. So we take away from that it is important for us to make good decisions about the transportation system as it affects a very important part of the people of Minnesota. Last year, we undertook a very large effort in trying to identify the what we're calling the 50-year vision for transportation in Minnesota. And I know, of course, none of us can predict what the world is going to be like in 50 years. So think of this as an effort that was trying to identify a long-term strategic approach towards transportation. This will be continually updated, but it is intending to look way out. And what we found is, again, the consistent issues that are arising is that Minnesota's multi-transportation system, we want it to maximize the health of our people, the environment, and our economy. Again, you see those sustainability components weaving its way through. But what also came out of our Minnesota Go work and outreach was these guiding principles. We've got these eight guiding principles, and And this validates the approaches we've been taking when we talk about the realism of today's world where the resources are limited. We need to leverage our investments to make sure that we're touching as many areas as we can and enhancing quality of life for as many people as we can. We also have to be cognizant of the fact that we need to build to a maintainable scale. We don't have unlimited resources, and we need to manage within those. Safety is MnDOT's absolute number one priority. I'll talk a little bit more about that later, and that came out. And also, another highlight is that we need to use partnerships to do this. We need to collaborate with stakeholders and the public to identify the best solutions for moving forward. Minnesota Go is kind of the vision approach to our larger program here. We've allowing the vision to kind of guide us through our statewide multimodal transportation plan, and then that drives our family of plans in each of the modes, including our highway investment plan. Now, SIMS is an outcome of all of that work. Corridor investment management strategy is a way for us to address some of the needs that have been very difficult to address given our past approach to developing our highway program. So we've got our vision that leads to our multimodal transportation plan, and then our modal investment plans, including the highway investment plan, and that is SIMS falls out of that approach. And SIMS is a multimodal approach. Often we link it directly to the highway infrastructure, but we want SIMS to really look at all modes, transit, other areas that can provide the mobility, the safety, and the economic development benefits that we're striving to achieve across the state. So the objectives here are, again, acknowledging the realities of today's world, the fact that funds are not that we have limited resources. We need to acknowledge that there are regional and local priorities that need to be addressed that cannot be addressed or have not been addressed through our performance-driven approach that looks at the preservation, mobility, and safety areas of the transportation system. We also want to make sure that we're being transparent in this approach, that we are collaborating with the stakeholders, and that there's an understanding of the investments we make based on these principles. We are striving to utilize the partnerships that we have gained and also that we are developing to make sure that we are approaching this in the best possible way. Again, it is about quality of life. It is about the transportation system's impact on quality of life and economic development and safety and mobility at a corridor level that SIMS addresses. We are developing forums for these discussions, this collaboration, this transparency, and in fact, this afternoon, I believe we're going to be sending out an invite to the ATPs, to the local stakeholders, to the corridor coalitions regarding some meetings that we're setting up over the course of this year. We expect to touch each of these corridor coalitions along with other stakeholders on the interregional corridors across the state, talking about SIMS, getting their feedback about SIMS, and also looking to develop this further as we move towards ultimately a solicitation that I will talk about again in just a moment. We are looking at SIMS as a way to implement high-benefit, low-cost strategies. This is an approach we have done widely in the metro area. That's really where it started. It's very costly to expand in areas of development and growth, and it's very expensive to expand in areas where there's not that. And so we're looking at ways that we can achieve the benefits, the majority of the benefits, for limited cost so that we can spread the available resources out and touch as many people and businesses as possible. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. One of the things that's different here is we've reached out to the other other state agencies. We've asked DNR, pollution control, housing, agriculture, tourism, and health to be a part of these SIMS meetings. And the reason for that is we believe that there's ways that we can coordinate investment. Again, using these partnerships to identify how we can work together to deliver more than we can individually. And again, we're after the same solutions that I've talked about throughout this. Talked about a SIM solicitation. We are committed to this solicitation in early 2013 as a first round. We see this as an ongoing process. We want to utilize the meetings this summer and this fall to identify how this program should go, what criteria should be used. We at MnDOT are working on a level of funding for this program. We have not developed that yet. I can tell you that it will be enough to address multiple corridors because that's our commitment to this. Again, these are the corridors that have really struggled in getting funding through our existing performance-driven approach. We've heard that there's frustration about trying to address these needs, these local and community priorities, and so we have come up with a corridor investment management strategy program that is bringing a reliable level, I'm not sure what level that will be, but reliable funding to address some of these needs across the state. Focus will be of the first round, again, is going to be on low-cost, high-benefit solutions that most positively impact quality of life, provide for economic development, address mobility, and address safety. And again, the advantages of these are they help us build a sustainable transportation system. You know, we have quite a challenge ahead of us right now just managing the infrastructure that exists today. We're using programs like Better Roads to enhance the pavement structure, but there's a lot of needs out there from bridges, from roads, and of course we want to continue our safety programs at the level that we've got them now or more, because as we continue to reduce fatalities, it's going to get more and more difficult. We do want to achieve as many purposes as we can with the limited resources we have. That's why we've asked the other agencies to come to the table. We are looking at strategic fixes. And one of the key things here is that we have come to a point where we can't just allow the traditional book solutions to be our answers. We need to engineer solutions that meet the preponderance of the need for much less cost. Now, I talked about TZD a couple times. I think many of you are familiar with that, but I do want to highlight it because not only have we utilized the TZD philosophy as a low-cost, high-benefit type of an approach, but it has proven to be effective, and it is a very big part of the needs that we have heard through these local corridors. As you know, I believe that in 2003 is when we began the journey towards zero death in Minnesota. We were at a point where we had 650 fatalities, and that was trending upward. We began a completely different approach that utilized the four E's, engineering, education, enforcement, and emergency medical services, a collaborative approach where we reached out to the local governments, and we began to implement low-cost, systematic safety enhancements that were addressing fatalities before they occurred in a very proactive way. The result has been, last year we had 367 fatalities, and since 2003 it has been on a very dramatic downward direction in terms of fewer and fewer fatalities. And we're striving to achieve that through our SIMS program as well. So I want to talk about some of the examples that we see for these low-cost, high-benefit solutions. The 2+1 is relatively new to the United States. It's been used quite a bit overseas in Europe and in Norway and such. This is a roadway that is going to use the footprint that exists right now in many of our roads if they have wide shoulders, where we can introduce a positive barrier between traffic. So we're using that cable median barrier that you've seen across the state. We recognize that for economic development, mobility is a very important aspect of that, and so we alternate two lanes in one direction. There are many things we need to study about these approaches, though. I mean, we need to, for any given location, we need to make sure that we're providing access to the highway, that we're truly providing a safer roadway. Agriculture equipment, things like that are all things that need to be considered. But we see this as a very probable positive strategy that we could use at much less a cost than some of the traditional solutions. Other examples are things called, like, for example, Super 2. A Super 2 is taking what has been a traditional two-lane where you have 12 feet of roadway and then about a 1 foot strip of pavement markings and then another 12 feet, so traffic is traveling very close to each other, and trying to separate that oncoming traffic. When we look at the crash data along some of these corridors with some higher volumes and higher crash rates, we see that cross center line crashes, head-on crashes, are a real problem. And so what we want to do is separate that traffic, put a bunch of rumble strips in between, try and get the attention of the driver so that they can correct prior to an incident occurring. We've utilized both of these two in Minnesota. The 4-foot buffer has been used on Highway 12, and it has been very effective in reducing head-on crashes. The 12-foot buffer was used on Highway 5 in Lake Elmo, and it has all but eliminated those head-on crashes since we put it in. Another area that we see a lot of issues with in greater Minnesota as well as in the metro area are four-lane divided highway intersections with two-lane cross streets. And often what happens is vehicles have difficulty negotiating those crossover maneuvers. And most often we like to have vehicles stop in the median, but sometimes they don't, and they cross over into the oncoming traffic, and we often see that we have a far side crash right angle problem. These J-turns reduce or in fact take away that movement, and I'm just going to point out here on this slide, so you can see that there's no ability to cross the intersection to continue in the other direction. What we're asking drivers to do here, although any driver could come and make a left turn onto the cross street, if you wanted to cross over or make a left turn from the cross street, we ask you to make a right turn first, which is a much safer move, go down the roadway, and then make a left turn and ultimately a U-turn. What that does is it separates the conflicts so that there's less for a driver to consider as they're making those movements, and it has proven to be very effective in reducing those very serious crossover crashes.
Comment about this too. Go ahead, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me at what speeds are the J-turn intersections best used for? Because I know we're considering that on Highway 52 and County Road 9, and I'm just wondering if you could speak to the speed level.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, in terms of the speeds that are most benefited by this type of approach, I think it is the high-speed roadways where that the traffic is coming at a pretty quick pace, and it requires you to look both directions and manage through that. You add a median to it, it adds even more difficulty to that. Some drivers don't know whether they should stop or not. But I don't think it is exclusive to high speed, but I think for high speed roadways, it's important that we look at trying to reduce the needs of the driver in terms of identifying what conflicts exist.
And I'll just make a comment in support of these J-turns. They are very effective on North Highway 71 in Wilmer. We used it as a strategy, and it met with, because it doesn't look typical, it met with a significant resistance at the time, but it was an intersection that was people were getting killed and injured regularly. It was a big problem that we had for a number of years. Implemented this J-turn system there and have eliminated the crashes since that time. So, and that's a 65 mile an hour roadway. So it's a very effective approach. So,
Mr. Chair, I was going to say the same thing up in Brainerd-Baxter 371. They put those in, and no question that it is much safer. And really, as much as I'm the kind of guy who wants to zip across and get going for an extra few seconds, it's very effective.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm glad you bring that up because, as we try and incorporate these different strategies that are intended, for safety, for mobility, for economic development, as we try new innovative strategies, they often are met with resistance. I can assure you that before we try these, we do a great deal of investigation into where they've been used before, how they will impact the local area. And it is with that great level of confidence based on our investigation that we asked to move these things forward. And they have been successful.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. On these G-turn intersections, is the 169 corridor a corridor that you would look at to utilize these J-turn intersections?
Mr. Arsenal?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, yes, I do believe that's the type of corridor. A divided high-speed interregional corridor would be something where a J-turn would make sense. I think Highway 52 south of St. Paul as well is another one.
Thank you. I was interested because I know that there is going to be some further testimony about this, but that this works well to add to the safety on four-lane highways, not just two-lane, four-lane highways that are like 169 that have many entrances and exits on them and where people want to cut across. So I think that particularly for 169, I'd be interested to see how we can use this on four-lane expansion.
Well, Mr. Arsenal, isn't on 169, and Senator Sharon, maybe you can answer this question too. I thought down by Jordan, aren't there a couple of these already implemented on Highway 169?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do believe that there is at least one. I just drove through there last night, and I know that the crossover was shut down. I mean, you couldn't cross over, and yeah, then you'd have to utilize this movement. So yes, it is used there.
I'm the one that's going the straight shot down 169 and not making the turn. But is this also what's happening at Belle Plaine at Emma? You know where Emma Crumbie's is on 169. There's that barricade now that makes it difficult for. I know Belle Plaine has a great deal of concern about the modifications that have been made in their area on economic development because of these restrictions and turn lanes. Would you be willing to speak to that?
Mr. Arsenal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm not exactly sure which. I know it was right around there that I drove through that last night, but I'm not exactly sure what intersection. You know, it is many of the things, decisions that we have to make as an agency balance things like economic development, safety, and so we need to do the trade-off risk analysis to say, you know, is the additional time worth the savings or the benefits and safety. And you know, each case is unique. Each case is different. And I would just point out, too, that it would be unlikely that – I know there was some talk about two lanes. It would be unlikely we'd use a solution like this on a two-lane. I can't really see that unless, you know, an undivided two-lane for sure. Two-lane, two-way. Okay? All right, I'm just about done here. I do want to give some examples of some lower-cost, high-benefit strategies that have been used in the different categories across the state. When we talk about congestion and mobility needs relative to congestion, the 35W corridor is really a state-of-the-art transportation corridor of the 21st century. It's been looked at by transportation experts across the world because of the technology we have deployed through there. We've utilized shoulders in some areas and mitigated any safety issues with technology that provides real-time information to the travelers. It has been highly successful. It does utilize MinPass to assist with transit and HOV vehicles, but also provide reliability along that corridor into the Minneapolis area. Another example is in a project that is currently under construction right now. Some of you have probably heard about this, but the 169-494 interchange, the book solution for that interchange would have been ramps to each direction, free flow ramps to each direction from each direction. And what we realize is that from the movement headed east to north, 494 headed east to north 169 was a low volume movement because of Trunk Highway 62. And also, similarly, the southbound movement on 169 to 494 westbound was a very limited use. It would be used in a very limited way, that ramp. It came at a cost of $20 to $30 million. We removed those ramps from that project, and therefore were able to take that additional or that $20 to $30 million that would have been put in a low productive way into that interchange and move it to other more high productive solutions across the metro area. Another example of that is the Trunk Highway 10 Snelling and 694 interchange, where we're actually saving in the neighborhood of $75 million, and most drivers who drive through that will never realize anything but a much freer flow today, and it'll look like a beautiful completed project. But this, it's an engineered solution. It is not a book solution. We're able to then take those resources and apply them to the great many needs that are across both in the metro and statewide.
These, can I ask a quick question?
Senator, sure.
I need some clarification. You're referring to a book solution. Is that not designed by engineers? Is that not an engineered solution? Or could you explain to me what the difference is between a book solution and an engineered solution?
Sure.
Mr. Arsenal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, the book solution is certainly one that was engineered by engineers. I mean, it was a developed solution, but it was a very conservative solution. It was one that did not really look at resources. And in previous years, we've had a very steady revenue stream into MnDOT. We've been able, and other DOTs across the country, we've been able to rely on those resources coming. It was at a time prior to much of the inflationary increases we've seen over the last 5, 10, 20 years. And we're just in a different world today. It's a new normal, and one that we have to recognize that even the federal reauthorization is challenging to get through, and we haven't been able to do it for the last 4.5 years. That we've got, you know, funding comes at much different ways, and it needs to be spread over a system that has grown over those 20 to 30 years to 40 years, and there are a great many needs. So we're in a different world today than we were when many of these quote-unquote book solutions were achieved
or
were developed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arsenault, I have a question for you on, we're talking about lower costs, and to me, lower cost isn't the only thing we should look at. We should look at value, long-term value. Can you talk for just a minute, when did that get so many dollars in for the yearly budget? You can either try and do a lot of roads, putting a little bit into a lot of roads, or you can do some long-term costs. Instead of asphalt, maybe you go to concrete, which may cost more, but may be more cost-effective in the long term. Can you talk about that just a little bit and the differences that the challenges you run into along those lines?
Mr. Russell?
Mr. Chair and Senator, what I would say is that when we talk about low cost, we're talking about low cost, high benefit. We don't separate those two. We have looked at purely low cost solutions in the past. We've got examples of spreading out thin overlays across a big piece of our thin overlay, bituminous overlays. What it does is it gives you for a short time a very smooth road, so it gets us to our performance measures. What we found is that it doesn't make sense to do that because there's not a long-lasting benefit to that. It's not a sustainable solution. So with low-cost, high-benefit solutions, we are looking at sustainability, and that's why I spent that time going through how we built into this SIMS program, is that the solutions we're striving to achieve are ones that are sustainable in nature. They are high-benefit, because they're going to address the safety, mobility, economic development needs, but they're going to do it in a different way, but it doesn't mean a less productive way. And the only solutions we're trying to deploy are ones that provide value to the citizens and the businesses of the state of Minnesota. I'm just about done here. I did want to highlight, too, in terms of SIM strategies, the cable medium barrier is one of the towards zero death strategies that's been very effective. Recently, there's been a crash that got a lot of attention, and the cable medium barriers was one of the topics of that discussion. We've been deploying that pretty heavily across the state, and it's gone a long way to helping us reduce our fatalities. There's also rumble strips, there's enhanced signing, and there's many more areas of towards zero death that we can talk about. So very quickly, this year we intend to again reach out regionally to all of the corridor coalitions as well as other stakeholders in greater Minnesota and in the metro area to talk about SIMS. The first meeting will be more of an introduction to SIMS. It'll talk about some of the things I've shared with you today. It will also get input from those stakeholders. And then we're going to have, as we go along through this year, we're developing our highway investment plan. SIMS is going to be a component of that. And We will reach out again this fall and try and finalize the criteria through which we will develop a solicitation that will come out this fall. We want to create an atmosphere that allows for collaboration, allows for discussion about what the needs are and how they can be met. And again, we're looking at that solicitation for early 2013. We do believe it'll be a very positive way of addressing some of these needs that have not met the thresholds of our performance-driven approach.
Senator Scher?
I know that you want people to testify, so I just, in a last comment, you're talking about meetings and getting feedback and getting input. I think that's important to not only get it but to utilize it, because there are engineers of expertise outside of the department that mm-hmm. are in these communities. But you talked about this fitting into an overall long-range investment plan. Would you talk about how you see that, what else is in the plan, and what is this? How does this fit into that overall plan?
Mr. Arsenal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes. We are in the process of developing our family of plans this year, which will ultimately lead to our multimodal investment plan. In terms of the highways, the 20-year plan is that plan. SIMS is going to be a part of the 20-year plan. Our 20-year plan has a 5-year STIP, and that has very, very specific projects that are programmed that are going to be completed. Then there's a 5- to 10-year portion that is less defined, that there is potential for flexibility to allow the department to be nimble based on the needs that arise. And in the 10- to 20-year portion of that 20-year plan, it is more of a principle and policy-based plan than it used to be when it was more of a project-based plan. So SIMS will be a component of our 20-year plan. It will be identified as a way to address these non-performance-driven needs for corridors such as 14, 23, 10, 53, all those corridors across the state that find themselves with high-priority local and community needs that have been difficult to address through our normal program.
Senator Sherman.
And then with the reorganization of how you're approaching a 20-year plan rather than like a capital projects listed out over and over, how will that impact federal dollars coming to the state? How does that affect the criteria that are required by the federal government for federal dollars to come to support projects in the state? Is it going to impact our capacity to draw dollars down, or for if certain projects are not on that specifically listed as particular kinds of projects to be able to receive federal dollars?
Mr. Arsenal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, I believe the approach that we're taking allows us to be more nimble in the way we address federal dollars. We are approaching this in a way that acknowledges that things change, that as we move along, you know, we can't predict what conditions will be in 5 years or in 10 years or certainly in 20 years. And so by having SIMS in it, it allows for those federal dollars to be directed towards SIMS needs. So I don't see it as a barrier. I see it as a benefit and an ability to allow us to be more nimble.
Very good. Thank you for your presentation. Before you go, and we want to leave plenty of time for the next segment of the hearing here, but do you want to talk a little bit about TFAC, the Transportation Finance Advisory Council, and what is MnDOT's vision as far as that fitting into the SIMS program? Is there a connection there, or do you visualize at some point in the future where the possibilities that will be generated from that advisory council will fit into this program?
Mr. Chair, members, the TFAC group, the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, is meeting actually, I believe, Friday here, and they are undertaking a look at transportation funding, and they're going to try and identify whether it's in financial approaches, investment approaches, but also just the pipe flow of revenue coming into us and whether there can be more. So they're going to be looking at a very wide spectrum related to transportation financing. If if they were to identify a revenue stream or additional revenues or make recommendations relative to those things, that absolutely would have an impact on SIMS as it would across our whole program. Because we've got, as I think you all know, we are trying to address the highest priority needs we have. We have a great deal of needs that cannot be met with our existing revenue. And so as we would, if we were so fortunate as to receive additional revenue, we would look at our whole program. And since these are our programs today under limited revenue, they would be our programs, as I foresee, in a day where revenue is a little higher.
Senator Perry?
Thank you very much. And I know we have... I know we have the folks from the Highway 14 partnership, and I'm stretched between two committees, and I'm pretty much I think I know what the Highway 14 partnership is here to talk about. But I just have one question, Mr. Arsenault, and this is what I really need to understand. And you and I have gone back since I was first elected, and you know my stance, and you know how I originally pounded on you and the commissioner about the lack of movement on Highway 14. I've been pretty quiet this year, other than the first committee meeting that I had with the chairman here about it, because I was led to believe things would be happening. My question is, why was Highway 14 dropped from the 20-year plan, and what were the factors that led the department to drop from the 20-year plan? And I think everybody wants to know what were the factors, because of the length of time that, 40-plus years, almost 50 years, we've been trying to get this this road that has had so many fatalities done on it. Why would we drop that from the 20-year plan and not even include it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, I'd like to be very clear that we have not dropped 14 from the 20-year plan. And that was what I was just trying to explain here, that our new plan allows for changes, unforeseen changes in the future. So we have created more of a policy and philosophy-based plan for the out years. We are very able to be nimble for as needs develop and as things go on. So 14 is not dropped from the plan. It is not called out specifically necessarily in the plan, but we changed from that kind of an approach because it set expectations that couldn't be met, and we struggled through that. So our new approach, as I was mentioning just a little earlier, allows us the flexibility to entertain revenue that we may not have anticipated or needs that were unknown or unable to address. I do want to mention one more thing about SIMS, because I just want to be very clear about this. Since the Commissioner Sorrell has come in to his position, and we are so fortunate for the great leadership that he has provided MnDOT, we have been hearing, and I became part of his leadership team, we have been hearing from corridor groups across the state. 30 of them is what we've got at last count, but there's certainly more needs than just those 30. And they express needs of safety. They express needs of mobility. There are all these needs across the state. And under our performance-driven approach, it was very, very difficult to address any of those needs. And so what we have done is created the SIMS program that is directed specifically at those needs that are very important to the locals, that are very important to the regions, that have been unable to pass the thresholds of our performance-driven approach, which I would say is an indication of the high level of needs that we have across the state in transportation. So we are putting, this is a direct result of the input we've gotten from people like Senator Sharon and Senator Perry and the other stakeholders around the state who have expressed this frustration about not being able to have their needs met. We are dedicating funds to directly that, and we're going to solicit our first program this early next year. But we are asking that in order to allow the limited resources we'll have available for that to touch as many Minnesotans as they can, that we look at these low-cost, high-benefit, near-term solutions. We don't want to preclude long-term solutions if for some, you know, some reason we were able to get these high level of funds coming into the department. We are not saying we're precluding those, but we are saying that we think it's important to address these mobility, safety, and economic development needs today. And we can do that for much lower cost with different approaches that have been proven in other parts of the country and world. And that's what SIMS is doing for us.
One follow-up.
Just real briefly, the SIMS program engages the corridor folks, the ATPs, the people in the communities in finding the solution that best fits their needs, not just for today, but for the future, and it actually gives them some additional input into what those needs are and how they can move transportation forward in that area. Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know why, Mr. Arsenault, that in my mind right now, your last statement leads me to believe that those that have the highest paid lobbyists, those that are the loudest, are the ones that are going to get their quarter or their job done. If you don't have a specific prioritized plan, which it appears that you're kind of opening up the SIMS and saying, well, all the plans are going to be there. But if you don't have a specific plan of what you're going to get done, that's how I'm thinking your final statement that you just made moves forward, that it's the lobbyists that are going to get, and that could be anywhere. And yet we have a project, and I know Senator Gimsey, I've gone round and round with him. He's got Highway 12. We've talked about that. But I am just, you know, I might on the floor start talking about how scary it is to know you have people traveling Highway 14, and I hear things that we're going to put the cable rail and the rumble strips. When you're going from the four-lane to the two-lane and you're going around curves, I'm frustrated. I think many southern Minnesota folks are frustrated. It appears that we're more willing to spend money, specifically in the metro area, than we are in greater Minnesota. And I am concerned that the fact that it isn't listed, Highway 14, in some plan, that, again, I go back to, you make me feel like if you get the highest paid lobbyist, we're going to make sure your project gets done.
Mr. Arsenault?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, I don't believe that's the case. In fact, I'm certain that is not the case. What we're doing, had we not been developing over the last many years our performance measures and those things that are driving our program, and had we not, as an example of the nature of our performance measures program, the last 2 years, we've gotten national awards for that program from Pew, for example, about actually using our performance measures in the delivery of our transportation system. So we do use those performance measures, and that's the driver. We are not, in fact, the purpose of SIMS itself is to set forth criteria that enables us to really be focusing on the highest benefit solutions for the public and for the stakeholders in this state. So I do not believe it is true that the highest or most expensive lobbyists, or however you phrase that, can drive our transportation program. Our transportation program is driven by what we hear from the people in Minnesota. We've outreached and we've talked to them through our Minnesota Go Visionary program. And through our quality of life research. We're incorporating that information into the program that we deliver. We're setting out a program of projects that's identified and created through the ATP process, which is distributed through the 8 districts of MnDOT and has local participation. We are setting up a program based on sustainability, quality of life, economic development, that best serves the people of Minnesota so that we can achieve our vision of being a world-class transportation system. That's what we're after.
Senator Scherer. And
thank you.
Members, we want to have a limited time frame. We want to respect that you brought folks up here from Highway 14 and that they want to
I really want to hear from them, too, because they're very concerned about this proposal that implies that it's based on some principles that that what you're describing here in the SIMS program in particular are short-term solutions. And Highway 14, even though there may be other corridor organizations, this is a project that's been up here waiting for this trickle-down effect for about 60 years. And along with this financing suggestion that maybe some private dollars would match or partnerships, that certainly is unlikely in the rural area. But if there's savings there, again, we're being asked for a trickle-down. Let's do some of these short-term solutions, and maybe sometime in the future we'll be able to find some resources to resolve a four-lane expansion in this area. I would be very curious to have you answer the question, because I really our coalition of the cities along Highway 14 are very, very, very frustrated, as you said. We do not believe things have been reorganized in order to support a SIMS project, which may make a lot of sense in a lot of places. So I don't want to say that what you're talking about here doesn't make – it simply doesn't make sense in relationship to what's happening on Highway 14. And this is a project that has done environmental impact statements, has had them done, has had these projects ready to go, have been included and promised that dollars would be spent, and only to have the environmental impact statements become obsolete and have to be repeated. This has been on the docket for so long, it's very difficult to understand why, with just some small portions left for completion of an east-west corridor, by the way, rather than something that's always fueling and feeding into the metro area, what it is in terms of criteria that, I mean, for example, does your prioritization take into account the future expected growth that's anticipated for this region that is applying? Already we've had enormous growth, as you've indicated from your own charts here, that are applying enormous pressure on this corridor. And the anticipated growth in this area is significant. Is that calculated into your considerations for what type of investment should be made in this part of the state?
Mr. Arsenal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scherer, all those things go into consideration when we come up with a solution. I guess what SIMS is trying to do here is what the SIMS program is trying to achieve are solutions to the needs that are across the state. Now, what I have heard a lot about Trunk Highway 14, and I have looked at the data a lot, and I understand the concerns on 14 very, very well. Safety is a huge issue for the people on Trunk Highway 14. Safety is my personal absolute number one priority. It is something that is very important to me. And so when I look at a road like 14, and I look at the greater system and the limited resources that they have, that we have, I am interested in trying to identify a solution that we can achieve sooner than later. And given the limited resources we have, if we can create a solution that, albeit is a near-term solution, but it doesn't need to eliminate the opportunity for other solutions in the future, I'd rather see a near-term solution that gets done now, positively affects the safety on that corridor, which I am certain we can do. And by the way, I do believe the Trunk Highway 14 corridor would compete very well in the SIMS program, and especially since we just presented that most recent safety audit. And I think it's important for us as good stewards of the system to look at what we can do today. And then, and you look at the cost of some of these alternative solutions that are going to achieve those safety benefits and some of those mobility benefits, that we can address more needs across the state. I just think that makes sense from a stewardship point of view.
I will stop because I know you want to, but I hear from what you're saying that you've already decided, so you might as well avoid public meetings in the rural area. that for an expansion of lanes is not appropriate for 14, and that's a very troublesome to me. And second, I just heard yesterday in this committee an expansion project in the metro area for MinPass, an expansion of a lane that the problem that you identified right up there is that it's not highly utilized all the time. So there's money for expansion there, but there's not money for expansion lanes where it's absolutely the criteria and the necessity, not only safety, which is enormous problem, but the economic pressures that are placed on these corridors and what the potential for economic growth is, which has a value to the rest of this state in terms of income tax and sales tax in this area, is significant. It really is clear to me from what you're saying here that this idea that there'll be some public input and there'll be some influencing of the decision-making process around this is not real. It's a decision's already been made, and you will hear from those of us who understand the complexity of the problems here and its unique nature from other corridors that we will resist that assumption, just right out of the gate, that assumption, without real integrity to the discussion about whether or not expansion is really the better solution.
Mr. Arsenal?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, I would say that expansion is not out of the question with Sims. That is a potential solution. In fact, one of the solutions I showed you is a significant expansion. So expansion is not precluded from being a solution that is achieved through Sims.
Senator DeCrife.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arsenault, I have a couple things I'd like to touch base with you on. One is it's something of a criticism. When your group went around to do the Minnesota Goal, the 50-year vision, I attended one of those. And the prelude to the meeting was a video that was shown that had a number of people talking about, you know, what they thought their vision was. And it was heavy on light rail. You know, we need more light rail. And to me, planting that seed was a planned thing to make sure that everybody was thinking about light rail before they moved into that meeting. And I objected to that. But on a more pertinent nature right now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask you about bonding. You know, there's a potential bonding bill going to be looked at, and a portion of that bonding bill could include roads and bridges. I'm not asking you to give me this answer now, but would you give me a report on, based on how large a bonding bill was and the monies that went into roads and bridges for state roads or for county roads and bridges, at what point do you start including some of these potential projects that that work, you know, that are very important to us? I have lived for the last nearly 40 years either just north or just south of Highway 14, and my family drives that road nearly every day. So it's also very important to me and my family and my constituents. So what I'd like to do is I would like you to, you know, get me some kind of an idea of how bonding could affect some of these decisions.
Mr. Arsenault.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we can do that. I think what we talk about is our bonding capacity, and we can also talk about some work we've done in identifying, you know, where there are countless needs, and there's a whole bunch, but we've identified what we're calling a highest priority set of needs that I think would respond to your question, so we can get you that information.
Well, thank you, Mr. Arsenal, for your presentation today, and we very much appreciate it and look forward to the continued implementation of SIMS and the recommendations of that Transportation Finance Advisory Council.
Great. Thank you.
I think what we'll do now is have the Highway 14 Partnership folks come up. Senator Dames, I think I'll have you orchestrate that and introduce your constituents.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much for allowing us to be at this committee meeting this morning. I truly do appreciate it. For the record, I am Senator Dames, and today I have with me members of the Highway 14 Partnership. The Highway 14 Partnership extends from New Ulm to Rochester. And today on my right, I have Mayor Bob Beisman, the mayor of New Ulm, Minnesota. Mike Levine on my left, the Mankato City Council President. We'll also be hearing from Richard Seabath, the Brown County Commissioner, and Les Abraham, the Owatonna City Council President. I'm going to keep my remarks fairly short so that we can get to the Highway 14 partnership folks, but Highway 14 extends through my entire district. I know it extends through quite a bit of Senator Sharon's district and Senator Perry's district. And I would just like to echo their concerns. We, as I've talked to Senator Perry and Senator Sharon in the past, we all three share some concerns about the severity and the danger of Highway 14 compared to a lot of other roads in the state of Minnesota. And it's getting worse as time goes on because the traffic is going up. Also, we're concerned about the economic development of that region with Highway 14 and the position it's in and the needs that it has. And, of course, that drives to the real concern, and that real concern is the funding for the improvements that are so severely needed in Highway 14. And with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Mayor Bob Weissman of New Ulm. Sorry, I got
that's okay.
Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Robert Boisman, and I am the mayor of the city of New Ulm. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I want to thank Senator Doms for inviting us to speak this morning, as well as Senator Sharon, Senator Perry, Senator Gimsey, for supporting our efforts and for your leadership. I'm here this morning along with several other Highway 14 members to tell you why Highway 14 must be a priority on MnDOT's 20-year highway investment plan. Put simply, if the four-lane expansion of Highway 14 is not a priority in the 20-year plan, it will then lead to more deaths, cripple more people, and cripple southern Minnesota's economy. Many of you are familiar with Highway 14. We've been here at the Capitol for many years pleading with you and the governor to finish Highway 14. Generations have made this same argument. Progress is slow. I guess you could even say non-existent. Specific segment I represent stretches from New Ulm in the west to North Mankato in the east. It's a heavily traveled road with hundreds of semis and heavy farm equipment sharing the narrow two-lane road with thousands more commuters, students, senior citizens, and others who use Highway 14 every day. Many of those heavy trucks come from New Ulm, whose trucking giants like DNA Trucking, AMPI, JNR, Shugel are based. The road is narrow, curvy, hilly, and it travels directly through small communities. Traffic is slow because there is little place for cars to make safe passes or exits. That doesn't stop folks from trying, however, and has led to many fatalities over the decades. In fact, 11 people have died in this stretch of road over the past decade, 42 overall in the corridor since 2001. This has led to a fatality rate that is twice the state ride average for rural two-lane roads. We've put up the rumble strips. We've got signs that tell you when the two-lane becomes four lanes and when it goes back to a two-lane. We put up signs that tell you how fast you're going. When you have a large amount of heavy trucks that need to reach their destination in a timely manner, they share the road with students heading to school or employees whose types of safety doesn't work. These type of safety measures don't work. The accidents keep on happening. We know that crashes occur along all types of roads. Tragically, Highway 14 is not the only highway where people get killed. What worries me most is how the problems along Highway 14 are only going to get worse in the next 20 years. We need you, the legislature, and the governor to make Highway 14 a priority. We've got all kinds of questions. Some of them have been asked already by the senators. Thank you very much for the time being with you.
Thank you for coming today.
Chairman, my name is Mike Levin. I'm the council president of the City of Mankato, and I'm also the vice president of the Highway 14 Partnership. Thank you for the opportunity today to speak to all of you. It's nice to, after 12 years of coming here asking and talking about Highway 14, I'm starting to recognize faces at the committee table. As Mayor Busman noted, the challenges presented at Highway 14 have only grown over the past decade and will continue to get worse in the next 20 years. Failing to fix Highway 14 now will lead to more deaths and cripple southern Minnesota's economy. Mr. Chairman, the Mankato-North Mankato, greater Mankato area is booming. Over the last decade, our growth has outpaced the average largest cities in the state by almost 8%. Slightly over $900 million has been put into the state coffers by the sales generated in the greater Mankato area over the last decade, $900 million. We are a significant economic engine in the state of Minnesota. And we expect a 2.5% increase per year over the next 10 years. And North Mankato anticipates a 1.5% increase over the next year, and that's related to our population. And so our population as a greater Mankato area is anticipated to grow nearly 24% over this next decade. That growth has exceeded an expectation that the state certainly has, and we've been planning accordingly to be able to meet that demand in the future, with one exception, Highway 14. While that's a good challenge to have, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. The roads in and out of the area are critically important to our future growth and prosperity, and Highway 14 is that key driver in that transportation network. Whether it's headed east or towards Owatonna or Rochester, or heading to the west towards New Ulm, Highway 14 is a principal arterial highway and interregional corridor for our area, and it only gets busier. In fact, MnDOT projects the segment to see a 60 to 80% increase in the traffic by 2025. Again, MnDOT's own statistics show that this traffic will increase even more than it is today. The two-lane rural Highway 14 was built in a different era with a different expectation for its use. It was never intended to handle the such traffic and growth we're seeing along the corridor today or in its future. And if the challenges we face today along this road are not addressed now, let alone the next 20 years, we'll be in a very difficult position. We know the financial reality of transportation spending in our state. We're not blind to that. We're not only the project in the area that has needs. That's been pointed out today. You've heard that several times in your committee work. But we're asking that the legislature and the governor recognize that Highway 14 exists in an area unlike any other in the state, with a massive growth expected, coupled with a troubling and tragic safety record. This needs to be in a 20-year plan, not just acknowledged, but it needs to be in that plan. We're asking not only legislature but the governor to make it a priority. To put this in a little bit of a better context, the safety audit that was released yesterday highlighted that 1 in 8 trucks, for every vehicle on the vehicle, 1 in 8 is a truck on Highway 14. The statewide average is 8% of the traffic on a two-lane road is trucks. That 1 in 8 puts Highway 14 at 12%. So we have a higher number of trucks. That's today. Within the next 2 years, Walmart is opening a distribution center in Mankato that will put 200 more trucks a day on the roadways. So just on a short term, as it was mentioned by the deputy commissioner, short-term solutions, we have a short-term need that's going to cause 200 more trucks to come onto that roadway on a regular basis. That's why we're asking for Highway 14 to be fixed now, not somewhere in the future, but fixed now. Anecdotally, my wife works with Mayo Health Systems. She travels once a week from Mankato to Springfield, Minnesota, which is just west of New Ulm, once a week. On any given opportunity, when she's counted the truck traffic that's headed in the opposite direction, whether she's going east or west, the low number is 68 in an hour and a half drive to 78 trucks on a two-lane road traveling 55 miles an hour. Thankfully, when she slid in the back end of a semi-truck last January, all she received was a broken fingernail because of the technology and the safety restrictions in the car. But the truck had no choice but to stay in the roadway to avoid the accident that occurred in front of them because there was an 8-foot shoulder. The standard is 10 feet, but Highway 14 has an 8-foot shoulder. Three of the four solutions mentioned in the MnDOT safety audit when it comes using the SIMS strategy calls for widening the roadway, creating the buffer zones, the rumble strips, within the existing roadway, narrowing the shoulder to make those accommodations. The fourth solution, which is one that the Highway 14 Partnership advocates for, is expanding the roadway to 4 lanes from Mankato to New Ulm. As it's been mentioned, it's a lot of money. We understand that. But if you can't, and Senator Sharon articulated it better, but if you can't expand Highway 14 today because of the funding constraints, then what MnDOT is telling the state of Minnesota, they're not going to expand roadways in the future at all, because this is the solution to mitigate short-term, small-dollar, big-gain values. The examples that were provided today when it comes to some of these Sims philosophies work great on four-lane roads, but the section we're talking about is a two-lane road. You can't put J-turns into a 22-foot lane road. There's no J to turn. And if you're going to expand it out to accommodate a J-turn, I suspect the right-of-way you're going to acquire to make that happen is going to be equal to or similar to expanding a road to four lanes. So I encourage this committee to not only include it in a 20-year plan, but articulate to MnDOT that this is an important part of the state of Minnesota. The economic corridor from Rochester, and heck, I'll even go farther west, Winona, to the Dakota border, is an economic engine that the state of Minnesota cannot shortchange any longer. It doesn't go north and south, doesn't add to the metro. But the economic vitality of not just southern Minnesota, but really Minnesota, is dependent upon this corridor functioning. Safety aside, economic development alone, jobs, this creates jobs. This maintains jobs. It saves lives for jobs. With that, I'm going to ask to turn this over to Commissioner Siebold.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak on behalf of Highway 14. Committee members certainly appreciate the opportunity, and Senator Dames for setting this up for us. I would like to focus on the process challenge that we've got here. By not being part of the 20-year plan for the state, we will miss opportunities. In the course of my 16 years as county commissioner, I took the opportunity to participate in the transportation fly-in that our state association had run annually. I was out there three times. The first time you're out there, you're learning how it all works. And the way it works, folks, 80% of the bucks that we need to get this done have to come from the federal government. It seems that's always the way it's been. And I don't know why, how it's going to change. We talked to our representatives in Washington, D.C. They say, well, we'll come up with the 80%. But from what we can see, it's not on the 20-year plan. So we come back and look here in St. Paul and find that it hadn't been always there. It got on for a couple of years. We did receive some federal money, so we got the program together. But it's got to be listed. It has to be ready to roll. It's already been stated that we've got the EIS taken care of for that corridor. The final stretch from North Mankato to New Ulm only needs one rubber stamp in Washington, D.C., and the other section from Owatonna to Dodge Center has had to be redone because it was on the shelf so long it lost its real value. These are dollars wasted if we allow ourselves to be pigeonholed. We need to be on that plan, obviously, even if the economic situation today is such that it moves to the back side of the 20-year plan. We've got a lot of things that are going to change in the next couple of years. One of them that's changed in Washington, D.C., is that the earmark system is supposedly gone. How long will that last? We're going to have a heck of an election in November, and I think a lot of faces are going to change. Policies are going to change. And we're really hoping our economic situation changes. So let's be poised to take advantage of all the work that's gone into this project thus far. We don't want to waste the opportunity. We want to be ready to move. In closing, I certainly agree with the safety factors and the other economic issues that were brought up by my compatriots. If you do get a moment, I would like you to look at this safety audit. It really hones in on the challenges we face, particularly from North Mankato to New Ulm, and it was done by consultant selected by Department of Transportation, and they point out the urgency that we're facing here. It can't be done just, well, with our organization knocking on doors. We genuinely need your help. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you for being here today.
And, Mr. Chair, on my right, I have Les Abraham. He's the City Council President for the City of Owatonna.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, and thank you. My name is Les Abraham. I am the President of the Owatonna City Council, and I'm also President of the Highway 14 Coalition. I thank you for giving us the opportunity. I'll briefly talk about Highway 14 on the eastern side of the corridor from Owatonna to Rochester. The segment between Owatonna and Dodge Center is the last remaining two-lane segment from Mankato to Rochester. Like others have said, failing to include Highway 14 expansion in the 20-year plan will lead to more deaths and cripple southern Minnesota's economy. This is particularly a concern for us in Owatonna. Like Mankato, we're experiencing massive new growth in population and traffic counts. Over the last decade, Owatonna has grown 14%, and we're expected to grow another 16% in the next decade. The taxable retail sales in Owatonna grew by 21%. This means more and more people are coming to Owatonna to do business and often traveling on Highway 14. The pressure of Highway 14 is magnified when you factor in the expected growth of Rochester, which sits on the east side of the corridor, and Rochester expects 22% growth in the next decade. The result of all the growth means that people on Highway 14, more people on Highway 14 than ever before. With the projections showing a 50% increase in traffic, the heavy truck levels between Owatonna and Rochester. Put simply, Highway 14, which already has a fatality rate above the statewide average, will only get more dangerous. It'll be more dangerous for our kids, more dangerous for our commuters, more dangerous for our patients who travel from the to and from the Mayo Clinic, and more dangerous for southern Minnesota residents who travel on Highway 14 to shop. We won't accept the outcome that is already too many fatalities who have lost loved ones on Highway 14. And it isn't just the ones that have lost, it's the people that have been injured. The ones that have an ongoing life with their an impact on their families. That is more tragic than the actual death sometimes itself. We can't accept it because it would create more tragedy. Highway 14 expansion needs to be a priority on the 20-year plan. It is the only sensible alternative available. We have already spent millions in preparation to build the road, and any other alternatives would be throwing that money away. We urge the legislature and the governor, Governor Dayton, to do all they can to make Highway 14 a priority. With that, I thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman and members, we'd now open it up for any questions.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I would like to ask, I see Mr. Lavin is there, and I also Bob Bussman, the mayor of New Ulm. If I hear you saying that you want to be on the 20-year plan. I think that if you heard the testimony, I'm sure you did, that you could be on the 20-year plan, but that the proposal might say for some of these alternative safety proposals other than a four-lane expansion. So I'm asking particularly also, you know, Owatonna, I'd be interested as well, but the corridor between New Ulm and Mankato being treated with in the short term with some of these options for dealing with trying to increase the safety of the road. Why is not that an adequate solution for what you're asking for when you say being included in the 20-year plan?
Mr. Lavin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon. That's not acceptable to us because it doesn't resolve the issues. It may take care of some safety issues, some. It will not even address the economic development potential of the corridor. And the long-term solution stated in that audit actually says a four-lane expansion would reduce head-on collisions. It would allow the access management that's been developed with the townships, cities, and counties along this corridor to be met. Because quite frankly, what's happening right now along Cortland and Nicollet, the two cities between Mankato and New Ulm, is they're saying, you know, we've been waiting 40, 60 years for this road to get expanded. We need to develop. We need to do economic development and allow our cities to prosper. So they're allowing corridor development to occur, which on the downside, it developed the road cost of going around those cities does increase. But the reality is they've been waiting, generationally waiting for this road to expand. So for us to accept these short-term solutions doesn't truly make Highway 14 as viable as it needs to be, which is a four-lane expansion. I really don't see, again, three of the four solutions are about using the existing roadway and just shrinking shoulder width and making expansion of cable barriers and rumble strips. There's a rumble strip that leaves North Mankato and goes all the way to New Ulm now down the center of the road, or it's on the sides. We've had people have head on collisions. We had people die since those have improved. What we're talking about is separating that traffic and allowing people the option to have more than just a ditch to choose, but actually another lane of traffic.
Here. Along that same line, many of our youth taking part in the plan of going to college while you're still in high school. That's a long drive from New Ulm to Mankato. There are many colleges in Mankato that accept this program. So we have many of our young students driving from New Ulm to Mankato to take college classes. And then, of course, driving home again. That's the busy time. Those are the times that the safety audit has proven that it is very, very dangerous to be on the road. I was at a meeting where a highway patrolman said, it's unsafe for us to go out and patrol during certain hours because we have no way to turn around. If we pull someone over, the shoulders aren't wide enough. So now we're going to narrow the shoulders to put wider rumble strips. To me, that's unacceptable. I appreciated all of your comments, along that line. But this needs to be fixed now. I would love to have someone drive me on the road when it's a four-lane. Because the way things are going now, I don't think I'll be driving anymore by the time that becomes an expanded four-lane road. And there's more people from New Ulm going to Mankato for health treatment. They're going to Rochester for health treatment. Personal family members spent hours and hours on that road. Just cringes every time they have to use the Owatonna little stretch there, that Dodge Center stretch. And, of course, when they get to Mankato, they look for a possible alternative road home other than coming the easy way, 14. It's very, very dangerous. So safety, okay, that's part of Sims. Okay, great. But it needs to be permanently fixed. And what we spend for a permanent fix is more in the short term, but in the long run, it's probably the cheapest fix.
And just one follow-up question. Thank you. This is for Les Abrams, who I enjoy seeing here, and I want to compliment you for your enduring law for a very, very long time in your role in the Highway 14 Partnership.
Thank you.
You're as old as the Highway 14 Partnership is.
Yes, I am.
So my question for you is, this is an east-west corridor, and I think it's important for this committee and for the department to understand the implications of an east-west corridor as opposed to expansions of lanes that flow into the Twin Cities area. Because yesterday you weren't here, but there was a need for a min pass lane and congestion issues. And you have often talked, and I remember this at the Highway 14 Partnership, about how the state's long-term investments tend to increase their congestion problem in the metro area because they do not focus properly on the regional center's connection in an east-west component rather than driving everything towards the metro area. And I wonder if you could talk more about why east-west corridors are important.
Well, it's like Mr. a spoke Abraham. In a wheel going into the metropolitan area is very important, but to have that ring around the outside to get people that can't go to the metropolitan area can connect with each other. And this is what we've got here is Highway 14 is like a part of that ring. It has to be there to tie everybody together, to allow people from Mankato, from New Ulm, from Rochester, wherever they're going, to get together, get from one place to another. And it's, we got this one link in this whole thing that's not done. And that needs to be done to complete that ring.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. And if I just would make a comment on that, I think that not just to Mr. Abrams, but the entire committee is 14 Partnership has been very clear that the East-West Corridor allows for some major economic growth outside of the Twin Cities area.
Yes.
And allows the rural communities like Nicollet and Cortland and others along the corridor to enjoy some economic development and growth to support their communities and their schools as well. But if the only process that rises to the level of investment for lane expansion is either going into the metro area or already in the metro area, the state is shooting itself in the foot in terms of allowing economic development to occur any other place effectively. Now, I remember when we first started this that we were really looking at the corridor as an economic development tool, that we wanted to increase our economic development. And now I hear, you know, and it's been so long that we've been talking about this, now you've had this enormous pressure, this 80% increase in traffic,
yes.
You know, huge increases anticipated by 2025 and population growth that will apply pressure to this. And now we have not a message about we need to have this to have growth. Now we have a reactive message. We're dealing with a problem. We're dealing with data that clearly indicates it's only going to get worse and that these short-term solutions that are proposed or may be proposed are inadequate, that it's a four-lane expansion. And members of the committee, I want you to know that much of the investment has been made in this corridor already. We're just talking about completing a project that has made that has been promised and committed to for 60 years, for 60 years at least.
Thank you. And one of the things that also along with this, if you want the three-lane, what you're using is existing roadway that has never been designed for the heavy traffic. All you're doing is you're adding lanes to one side or the other, but that original roadway, you still have to maintain that, and you have to maintain or increase the maintenance because of the heavier traffic. So it really is not a good, viable alternative to what you're looking at doing is fixing it and making it four-lane.
Well, thank you very much for being here today, Senator Dames. Appreciate you bringing in the Highway 14 partnership and your testimony. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted, as a metro area legislator, to express my support for doing what we need to do on Highway 14. I've been in the legislature for 12 years now, and I think every year we've heard a lot about Highway 14. And so you're doing a fantastic job of sustaining the effort and the pressure and organizing, and it sounds like the organizing is getting better and better over the years. Just a couple of quick points, though. Mr. Chair, I think your testimony about Highway 14 and its role in mobility and safety was very eloquent and on point, but I also think your point about economic development was just as eloquent and equally on point. And that's really what transportation is about, whether that's Southwest Corridor light rail transit or Highway 14 or any kind of corridor improvements that we make when it relates to capacity and enhanced mobility and access. So I just wanted to find common cause with you on that as we're having a debate about something similar in the metropolitan area. I also wanted to point out that we just decided to devote about $600 million to build an enormous bridge over the St. Croix that's oversized and too big. It's going to suck up a lot of money. A lot of that money could have gone into Highway 14. That was money that was not programmed for that purpose. Would have been nice if we had had a statewide effort to say, there is a solution to that Stillwater Bridge that would address the mobility and safety needs and access needs and the pressure on downtown Stillwater that wasn't as supersized. That bridge was designed for a bygone era, and the average daily trips have gone way, way down. You know, and what was the big news immediately following the announcement of the passage of that bill in Congress. So all we heard about for a week was all the development now that we're going to be doing in western Wisconsin. That bridge was to do development in western Wisconsin. That's what we did. So we're pissing away, pardon the language, hundreds of millions of dollars on a bridge that was unnecessary that we could have used around the state for purposes like Highway 14. And then finally, you know, in 2008, we passed some provisions that add some dollars to our transportation system. We did it over the objections of a lot of folks who are still in service here and over the objections of the governor. But even then, at that point, we said we're probably only addressing a third of what has been identified by the department and by independent verification. So we're going to have to return to that discussion about the level of resources that we're putting into our overall transportation system statewide. And so I invite you to be a part of that conversation as the years unfold.
Senator Nance.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, on behalf of Senator Perry, Senator Sharon, and myself, I just want to thank the committee for allowing us to bring in the Highway 14 partnership and allowing them to come in and participate in this hearing today. It does magnify the importance of Highway 14, the safety issues, the economic development issues, and the need for keeping this project on top of the list to get this done. So with that said, I would also like to thank the Highway 14 partnership folks for coming in and testifying. We truly appreciate it. And again, thank you and your committee.
Okay, thank you. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for coming.